You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome everyone to the session of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Today we will hear three cases. The justices of the Supreme Court are happy to be in Washington Courthouse for our oral arguments today. Oral arguments normally occur in the courtroom of the Thomas J. Moyer Ohio Judicial Center in Columbus. If you're watching online or on television, you can see that we are in a high school auditorium, a very lovely, wonderful high school auditorium. Today marks the 80th session of off-site court. It is a tradition reminiscent of the early days of the court when in the 1800s there were only three justices and they heard cases where the case occurred. That was called riding the circuit because they traveled the state by horseback. Today we come by car at the invitation of Judge Stephen Bethard of the Fayette County Common Pleas Court. Holding oral arguments outside of Columbus allows more Ohioans the opportunity to experience the Supreme Court in person. When we take our oral arguments on the road, we go to high schools rather than local courthouses so that more members of the public, especially students and the faculty, can take part. We're honored to be at Miami Trace High School in Central Ohio with students joining from Washington Courthouse High School and Fayette Christian High School. We have been extended a sincere welcome by the faculty, the staff, and of course, the students. For American democracy to function well, it is critical that our citizenry understand how our institutions of government work. The judiciary has an especially important task in our society. Citizens, too, have a responsibility. All of us have a duty to educate ourselves about our three branches of government so that our democratic institutions can survive and function well for everyone. At this time, I want to thank our host, Miami Trace School District and Superintendent Kim Pitzner, Miami Trace High School Principal Brian Sheets. I also want to thank the superintendents and principals and staff from the other Fayette County high schools in attendance for bringing their students here today. Many people have worked to make this court session possible, and I would like to thank all of the members of the judiciary, Judge Stephen Bethard, who issued the formal invitation, Fayette County Probate and Juvenile Court Judge David Bender, and Judge Victor Pontius, Jr. of the Washington County Washington Courthouse Municipal Court. I also want to acknowledge the work and the support of the Common Pleas Administrator, Carmen Baird, and the Clerk of Court, Sandy Wilson, and the Fayette County Bar Association. Fayette County is served by the 12th District Court of Appeals based in Middleton. To our audience and viewers watching on your televisions and computers, welcome to this official session of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Our first case this morning is 2021-622, the State of Ohio versus Emily Weaver. For the appellant, Ms. Troutman.
Thank you. Chief Justice and Associate Justices, may it please the court. My name is Rachel Troutman, and I'm here on behalf of Emily Weaver. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. So the purpose of post-conviction in Ohio is for petitioners to raise constitutional challenges to their convictions and their sentences, and there is no right to counsel for the average petitioner. There is no right to a hearing. All we are asking for in our second proposition of law is for this court to require that a fair and impartial fact finder be provided in post-conviction. The presumption currently is that the trial judge, the judge that heard the case at trial, is in the best position to consider the case on post-conviction. We ask this court to remove that presumption. The Supreme Court in Williams versus Pennsylvania said that bias is easy to attribute to others and difficult to discern in oneself. And it is in part because of that that we also ask that this court find that the appellate court does not owe the same amount of deference to a trial court's post-conviction determination of credibility as it does to a jury's determination of credibility. Emily Weaver received the most severe sentence that was possible. As the appellate court found after reviewing the post-conviction the first time in Weaver 2, The court said that the psychiatric and cultural issues surrounding neonaticide provided information to contextualize the same actions that the court used to support the life without parole sentence, and that the evidence in post-conviction was directly in contravention of the arguments that the state provided and the judge accepted in imposing the most severe punishment available for the offense. The trial court, for example, found that Emily Weaver lacked remorse. But it was not a lack of remorse. Emily Weaver physically shut herself down. She was in such a state of denial that even her body operated as to hide the fact that she was pregnant. It was denial and detachment from reality. Dr. Haskins' reports that predate even the trial, demonstrate that Weaver was indeed remorseful and that she took responsibility for this crime. And the trial judge also pointed out in sentencing that Weaver was more concerned about herself than the baby. But if you take it in context with the pregnancy negation, Emily was describing, it was an honest reflection of what was happening in that moment. It was not putting herself before the baby, because at that moment, it was not a pregnancy and an experience she was expecting to have. The court found that she tried over and over to take the baby's life. But when you look at it in context of that negated pregnancy and her mental health, it is not efforts to take the baby's life over and over. It is desperate acts of conformity. She wanted to believe, and she tricked herself into believing, that everything was fine and she was not, in fact, pregnant, until the moment it was too late. The court found that her relationship to the victim is what caused this offense. Yes, but that is why maternal mental health is so important. And trial counsel recognized this issue. He did. He simply only offered 5 sentences to the trial court as to why this even mattered. He told the court that this type of problem is a societal problem, because young girls who are doing well, they are perfectionists, that this happens, and that any sort of sentence he could impose on Emily Weaver wasn't going to lead to deterrence for the future. But he provided nothing to the court demonstrating that this was, in fact, a negated pregnancy, and that Weaver didn't go from simply being an honor student one day to a cold-blooded killer the next day. And he didn't provide anything as to why this is actually mitigating. The picture of Emily Weaver changed with that objective evidence. So, what happened at that hearing? We provided expert testimony. It was not refuted by the state. This is not a battle of the experts. Then we used outside the record, or provided evidence that predated the trial, to demonstrate that what the expert was saying was in fact supported by the evidence. But the trial court permitted victim impact testimony from the state. The state called the sorority sisters to testify about how they had reacted to what occurred that day. And the trial court then asked each of the sorority sisters, read to them portions of Weaver 2, and asked them if the Court of Appeals was actually blaming them for what happened and how they felt about that. That was inappropriate, as the Court of Appeals found, as well as the fact that the sorority sisters were even permitted to testify about this victim impact evidence. It had nothing to do with the underlying issue, which was the ineffective assistance of counsel during sentencing. The trial court refused to even credit the expert, despite the fact that she was qualified to testify under Rule 702. He assumed that she made up the terminology, even though the terminology was backed by decades of research, as had been provided to the court and was listed in her curriculum vitae.
Counsel, did the state accept this witness as an expert?
Initially, yes, Your Honor. The state did accept the witness as an expert. After she testified, and the following day after she left, they brought up issues such as the fact that she had suffered from postpartum depression herself, and asked the court to discredit her as an expert, to not find that she was indeed, to credit her testimony.
Didn't the trial judge find that she left out statistics that should have been included in her report?
Yes, the trial judge found, there are 2 relevant statistics in the issue of negated pregnancy, and she listed the one in her report that dealt with up to 20 weeks. It wasn't an inaccurate statistic. It just didn't include the one that occurred after.
It was kind of irrelevant to this case, though.
It's 100% irrelevant. The statistics don't really matter when it comes to the issue. And that's kind of the point. This was very, very particular to Emily Weaver and to what happened to her and to the fact that she wasn't making this up as we went along, as the court accused her of doing and accused the expert of doing.
Well, you said we presume it goes back to the trial judge. What rule would you have us write?
Well, there are a couple rules that we would have you write, Your Honor.
This issue on the second prop, that's just...
Yes, the second proposition of law, we would ask this court to require a fair and impartial fact finder.
Well,
simply,
don't we assume that the trial judge is fair and unbiased?
We do, Your Honor. However, that case law with regard to post-conviction is, there are asterisks to it. When it comes to post-conviction, this court has recognized and talked about in State versus Davis that the very nature of post-conviction relief proceeding requires trial judges to evaluate and pass upon their own actions and conduct. And this court talks about how a post-conviction judge should only recuse himself if a petitioner shows that the judge is a source of information otherwise unattainable. So we're asking this court to recognize and to permit trial judges to recognize that they are not necessarily in the best position to hear post-conviction cases.
Would we then have to say to a trial judge, if you rule one way or the other on a motion to suppress, you can't hear the trial?
No, Your Honor. I think that if we empower trial judges to make the decision as to whether or not the information that they had prior to the post-conviction, you know, grant them that ability instead of saying to them that you are in the better position to rule on this post-conviction than any other judge, I think we might find trial judges actually recuse themselves from post-conviction cases to begin with. But more than that, we would also, if we don't have trial judges that do that, because let's be, it's like an effective assistance of counsel claim. There may be trial attorneys who can evaluate their own performance in trials and determine when they were ineffective. But we don't require them to do that. We recognize that there is something there that you can't always see your own errors, and you can't always look at it from the 1,000-foot view.
But we do allow trial attorneys to file appeals. Correct?
We allow trial attorneys to file appeals.
Even if they lost the case, right?
Right, which we are not asking this court to say that no trial court can rule in a post-conviction. That's not the law. That's not the rule.
That's why I'm asking, what rule do you want us to write?
We want the appellate court to be granted simply if there is a rule that a fair and impartial trial judge is required for a to hear a post-conviction, and taking away the presumption that a judge who heard the trial is in a better position to hear a post-conviction, then the trial judges themselves, one, are empowered to step down, and two, there are three judges on appeal who can then review the record and determine whether the petitioner got that to which she's entitled to. Because the law presumes, in an ineffective assistance appellate counsel claim, the law presumes that a decision maker is reasonably, conscientiously, and impartially applying the standards that govern the decision. We're just asking that that's what happens.
Counselor, on your first assignment of error, your first proposition of law, you were saying that the appellate court does not owe as much deference to the trial court. I'm assuming here you strictly mean in terms of determining the credibility of the expert witness?
Well, yes, Your Honor. There are multiple different ways to answer that question. One, in any post-conviction case, we believe that the appellate court should be empowered to review credibility determinations for lay witnesses and expert witnesses to determine whether the record supports, whether there's competent and credible evidence that supports those credibility determinations. When there is an expert witness, there is a certain level, they're different than lay witnesses. They've already been qualified as expert witnesses.
Can the trial court determine whether they are, quote, qualified as expert witnesses?
Absolutely, Your Honor. They can determine whether they are qualified. But this court found in State versus White that a trial court can't just arbitrarily ignore an expert unless there are objective and supported reasons for doing so.
And your assertion here, of course, is that the trial court completely ignored this expert. Is that correct?
Yes, we're asking that the premise behind State versus White apply to credibility determinations of experts as well.
And the state did not offer a competing expert for the expert in this case.
Correct, Your Honor. It simply was a dispute as whether this is an expertise at all and whether Emily, in fact, fit within this criteria.
So the defense's theory at trial was that, that the baby died on its own in some way. And that when she put, there was no heartbeat when she put the baby in the trash bag. And wouldn't it have been very difficult for counsel to shift gears at sentencing and argue that present a completely different theory on what happened?
Well, it's not a completely different theory.
It is a different theory if what they argued at trial was, the theory at trial was that she didn't, that the baby was already dead, right?
Correct.
So this is a pretty different theory than that.
The defense did not dispute that proper medical intervention might have saved the baby's life. So that in sentencing, that's why trial counsel, first of all, he wasn't switching gears than what he had already planned on doing because he did bring up the issue. So he didn't have a strategy to not present this evidence. He brought it up as an issue to be considered. He simply just didn't do it well. He simply didn't use the evidence, and he simply gave no reasons as to why. But there, the point was that Emily wasn't expecting she was pregnant. She was 5'7", 145 pounds. Before the pregnancy and after the pregnancy. And when she delivered that baby, despite the trauma to her body and everything that happened in the moment, she didn't believe that the baby survived. And that was the defense's theory. And that's exactly what happens in most of these negated pregnancy cases. We've got a couple around Ohio right now. The record supports that this is, or I'm sorry, not the record, but outside of the record evidence shows that this is an issue. At this point, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. If this court has no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Bennington.
Chief Justice, fellow justices, may it please the court. My name is Taylor Bennington. I'm with the Muskingum County Prosecutor's Office on behalf of the Appellee State of Ohio.
Also, will you hold the microphone a little closer? Thank you.
Yes. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for amicus. Today, we're asking this court to uphold the decision of the Fifth District Court of Appeals, and we're asking this for several reasons. The first being because credibility determinations made by a trial court during post-conviction proceedings are owed deference.
Can you raise the microphone a little bit more?
I'm sorry.
That's better, thank you.
Are owed deference by an appellate court and are to be upheld absent an abuse of discretion.
But Counselor, what about if the record is devoid of support for the trial court position?
In that case, then that would be the determination of the court, but that's not the case with
That's
Ms.
not the
Weaver.
Case here, you're saying?
Correct.
So what evidence supported the trial court's determination that the expert's testimony was not credible?
Sure. So throughout the two-day hearing, the trial court heard the evidence, heard the testimony of Dr. Barnes, and there were numerous reasons to discredit her testimony. There was a lack of credentials from the very beginning. She was certified within 30 days of the hearing. The certification didn't exist at the time of trial or mitigation for sentence. She was unsure of continuing education requirements required for her certification. She was not sure of the-
Did you say certification didn't exist at the time?
Correct.
All right, so the science or whatever hadn't caught up, it didn't exist, but you're saying she wasn't sure of what was required to be certified?
It's not that the science didn't exist, Your Honor. It's that there wasn't a certification in place.
There was not one in place. So.
Correct. Okay. And that's relevant to show that at the time of the sentencing, when defense counsel was presenting mitigation evidence in support of Ms. Weaver, Dr. Barnes nor any other expert could have testified in this area at that time.
But the state didn't offer any contrary expert to say what this doctor is testifying to is voodoo science or doesn't exist or shake her credibility. If it's a newly developed area, because this type of crime isn't as rampant, if there's nothing conflicting or to contradict the expert testimony that the trial court has, can the trial court still have the authority to just summarily dismiss it?
A few things to touch on with that. So it is correct the state did not present an expert to refute Dr. Burns' testimony. However, they were not required to. Dr. Burns' testimony was based on information provided by Ms. Weaver following her trial, and it simply did not add up to the facts as presented at the trial and what actually occurred in this matter. Dr. Burns was discredited throughout the hearing, and I'll go into that in more detail at this time. The
counsel, what do you mean? It didn't add up to the facts.
Correct.
Her analysis, her diagnosis, her discussion of what was going on and related to the defendant. What didn't add up?
So Dr. Burns' testimony was based on this idea that Ms. Weaver felt isolated. She felt like she lived in a hostile environment, that she would not have the support of her sorority sisters.
Did they know she was pregnant?
They suspected that she was pregnant. They asked her on numerous occasions if she was pregnant. Every time she denied. They observed her doing things such as engaging in high-risk activities, taking a pill that would cause miscarriage. She was doing things that added up to the sorority sisters suspecting that she was pregnant. She was gaining weight. Her clothes were getting tighter. She was carrying around stuffed animals, covering her stomach with a pillow around the house.
Counsel, couldn't those facts support allegation that she felt isolated?
It could in that sense. However, that's not what she stated at the time of these events, and it's not what she stated during the trial. These ideas did not come up until after, when she spoke with Dr. Clara Lewis regarding her post-conviction relief petition. So Dr. Barnes's assessments were based on that information, and it simply just did not add up to what actually happened in this case.
What is your account of what actually happened?
I'm sorry, what was that?
What is your account of what actually happened in this case?
So in the fall of 2014, Ms. Weaver was a student at Muskingum College. At some point, she went to the wellness clinic at the college in order to obtain birth control, which required her to take a pregnancy test. They informed her that they would be in touch within the next 24 hours with those results. Messages were left, emails were sent to her student account, voicemails, we have your results, please contact us. She never did. Eventually, as a last resort of notifying her, they said, you know, please reach out to us or else we're going to have to send this to your residential address, which we don't want to do. We have sent it to you by certified mail. Please pick it up so we know it's been delivered.
When you say send this, what was the this?
The test results.
Okay.
Ms. Weaver goes, signs for the results. That was discussed throughout the trial. Within a month, I believe, she and her the suspected baby's father planned a trip to Planned Parenthood in Columbus and actually began their travel to the abortion clinic. An ice storm, a freak weather incident caused the interstate to shut down. They turned around and had to go back. Following all of this, she engaged in high-risk activities. She had researched pregnancy issues related to delivery. She, you know, again, like I said, took black Koch pills, which on the bottle say that this can lead to miscarriage. Within 2 weeks, she took 80 out of 100 pills.
So are you bringing all these facts to light to try to challenge the credibility of the expert that was excluded? Because I thought that this was focused on sentencing and ineffective assistance of counsel. And I thought that we should be, what we're supposed to look at is what the judge did at the post-conviction hearing. Am I off on that?
That is correct, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I was answering Justice Stewart's
because
question.
The sentence isn't, this, the underlying conviction isn't really what we're talking about here. We're
correct.
Talking about the sentencing and what the trial judge did in the post-conviction hearing. Am I correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And so the key focus here is that the trial court properly found Dr. Barnes not to be credible. And again, going back to those reasons, she would switch terms. She would say that there was pregnancy denial, and then other times say it was just mere concealment.
By she, you're talking about the expert now.
Correct, Dr. Barnes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Both of those fall under this category of pregnancy negation. However, they are separate and distinct concepts that she had distinguished throughout the hearing, yet she would flip back and forth, couldn't decide which terminology she would like to use. It was based on whatever fit her opinion at that time. The judge was also concerned about her explaining everything away, and there are numerous examples of that throughout the record.
But do I have it correct that the judge didn't exclude her testimony until after closing arguments?
After the parties presented all of the evidence, the judge then made his findings and found Dr. Barnes not to be credible.
But do you think that was fair? Because wouldn't the petitioner, at least the petitioner's counsel, want to know that evidence was excluded in order to properly frame closing arguments before the judge?
It's not unfair, Your Honor, and that's just because this is part of the trial court's decision-making. The trier of fact is in the best position to weigh the evidence and view the credibility of the witnesses, and this was just part of his findings. He didn't find her to be credible in this context, and it's not that he didn't understand the concept she was presenting with neonaticide and pregnancy negation. It's not that he wasn't believing that these terms exist. It's just that he didn't find them believable in this case, that they didn't apply to this case. And that's after the two-day hearing was held, all of the evidence was presented, appellant was able to call an expert of her choice, present affidavits and evidence in a light most favorable to her, and it wasn't until all of this evidence was presented that the trial court used his authority to determine that he didn't find the expert to be credible.
But if this were a trial, before closing arguments would be made to the fact finder, in this case a jury, the counsel would know what evidence was in and what evidence was out, because it would be important for the fact finder to have that in mind in listening, well, for the attorneys to be presenting the right information in making their arguments to the fact finder. So isn't this kind of parallel to the first proposition of law that maybe the Court of Appeals shouldn't give the same deference to post-conviction determinative credibility as it would to a jury's determination? If it's that loosey-goosey, for lack of a better term, in the post-conviction hearing, then maybe it's okay for the Court of Appeals to have a little more leeway and not as much deference to the post-conviction determination of credibility. What do you think?
So if I'm understanding your question correctly, Your Honor, it sounds like this would be an overrule of this court's decision in Gonder regarding the standard of review and the deference provided by the reviewing court to the lower court. And as this court analyzed in Gonder, Gonder just makes good sense for the right reasons. It allows for this deference that trial courts are owed in their fact-finding, and a trial court isn't in a unique position to consider claims like ineffective assistance of counsel in post-conviction relief petitions. They're the ones that hear the live testimony, observe the demeanor, they are gestures, voice inflections. They are in the best position.
But counsel, one of the things that the trial court judge said was, I find Dr. Barnes's testimony to be the most unusual testimony I've heard in 40 years. Do you know if the trial court ever had a case like this before it?
I'm not sure about this specific trial court. A few years prior to this, in the early 2000s, there was another case from Skingham University with a similar set of facts, and neonaticide was, I'm not sure if it was actually used in that terminology, but that was one of the considerations in that case as well. It was a different set of charges, a different sentence.
So you're not sure whether it was before the same trial court judge?
Correct.
So saying that this was the most unusual expert testimony the trial court's ever heard in 40 years could be because you never heard a case like this before.
Absolutely. There could be an expert in a new area before the court in any given case. However, it's the court's determination, it's the court's responsibility to determine how much credibility they are afforded.
But if you're basing how much credibility they're afforded on the fact that you've never heard it before, how does that make the trial court's decision?
Sure. So there are several things that this expert had presented to the trial court. Diagnostic tools, for example, that she had used were found not to be credible.
Found by the trial court based on no knowledge of this?
I'm sorry?
You're saying some diagnostic tools she spoke about the court found not to be credible, but the court again admitted never even hearing about this. So what basis did the trial court determine they weren't credible if he never heard about this testimony?
I will say neonaticide was brought up during the sentencing.
Sorry, say that again?
Neonaticide was discussed at sentencing by defense counsel as a mitigating factor. The issue is, in this post-conviction hearing, was whether it should have been addressed more. And I apologize, I would like to touch briefly on the bias argument. So I would just note that the judges are presumed to be fair and impartial until such time that petitioner makes a compelling showing of bias. And in this case, it would have to overcome the presumption of judicial integrity. Everything on the record, a review of this two-day hearing was held, just fails to meet such a high bar.
Counsel, let me ask you about that. The trial court judge initially denied a hearing in this case, correct? And he was overturned on that.
Correct.
Do you concede that he made disparaging remarks about the appellate court that returned it back during his on the record?
It absolutely was not a perfect hearing. However, it was proper for these questions to be asked specifically of the sorority sisters because the opinion in which Dr. Barnes's appellant's witness was based on was not consistent with the facts of the case. So questioning fact witnesses who were there at the time to find out if Dr. Barnes's was relying on bad information was the appropriate way to show a lack of credibility.
And one other concern I'd like to ask you about is the judge didn't even stop to deliberate or take a break after the hearing and arguments were presented. He ruled immediately from the bench. Does that concern you?
It doesn't concern me, Your Honor, and I notice I'm out of time if I may finish answering the question. But
Bond, Chief?
Yes.
Thank you. It's not concerning in the sense that he had sat through the two-day hearing, had listened to the evidence, was able to take that into consideration. Just the fact that he immediately rolled from the bench doesn't mean he didn't weigh everything appropriately.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. I'm presuming you've used Mr. Hendershot's time? Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Oh, we did.
Marshall? All right. I'll give you 2 minutes, Mr. Hendershot.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. As amicus, in these 2 minutes, I want to try to make three quick points, one jurisdictional, one legal, and one factual. Jurisdictionally, I think 90% of the discussion so far has been about the record in this case. Was there bias here? Was there ineffective assistance of counsel here? That's not an enduring legal question. That is something that is bigger than this case. And so that's why we've suggested in our brief to dismiss the case as improvidently allowed. That's the jurisdictional point. I think that connects to the legal point that I want to make, which is the standard that my friend here asked you to implement, number one, is directly contrary to State versus Gondor. And I can't really improve on what Justice Pfeiffer said at paragraph 55 there, speaking for the unanimous court. He said, trial judges who sat through the trial, when judging this kind of claim, ineffective assistance of counsel, and now I'm using Justice Pfeiffer's words, are in an especially strong position to evaluate whether there was deficient performance in the trial they sat through. And also,
counsel, accepting Gondor governs this case for review purposes, you do agree that we could still find that the judge abused their discretion?
You could, Ron. I guess I'll use that to segue to the third point, given that time is so short, and that is the factual point here. Using even the standard that's implicit in Gondor that my friend asks you, is there competent evidence to support what the trial judge did here? And Ms. Bennington has mentioned a couple of things like the wrong statistic and the problem with the scoring rubric that the expert used. But I'd encourage you to look at something in the transcript that deals with something the expert said demonstrated what was going on at the moment of the birth and the neonaticide. She said that Ms. Weaver perceived the child as a 4-inch mass of tissue. This is at page 41 of the post-conviction review transcript. But on cross-examination, this is at page 102 of the transcript, it's revealed that that statement was something that Weaver made to doctors 4 days after the birth in West Virginia. Weaver does not remember that interview at all. So this is something the expert was saying, describing the child as a 4-inch child instead of a 19-inch fully formed child, demonstrated the dissociation and the problem there. But on cross-examination, that was not a true reflection of the record. Weaver described this as a fully formed baby to the person she thought was the father in a text hours after the birth. So what the expert did here, it's not a matter of the expert's field being questioned or being brand new, Justice Stewart, to you your point. It's about whether that field of expertise actually applied, actually described what happened in this case. I see the red light is on. We do ask that you dismiss, and if there are no further questions, either dismiss or affirm the Fifth District's decision.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just a few quick points. First,
if you'll pull the mic down and speak into it, please. Thank
you. Yes, ma'am. Sorry. First, to follow up on Justice Donnelly's question, yes, even under Gondor, this court can and should reverse. But overruling Gondor and requiring a de novo review with constitutional claims would actually put this court in line with other states, which we submitted a bunch of additional authority last week. And it's consistent with what this court did in State versus Herring, post-conviction case, in which this court reviewed the trial court's ineffective assistance of counsel claim and did a de novo review and finding that the in reversing. I would like to point, I would just read just a portion of Dr. Haskins' opinion. Again, this predated the trial. And Dr. Haskins said that even though she had no recognizable mental illness, she had what most would consider a rather serious problem with the denial of her pregnancy and her failure to deal with that pregnancy in a realistic and planned manner. She basically dealt with being pregnant by not dealing with it. Again, this predates the trial and predates Dr. Barnes's involvement. When the other case, I think Justice Stewart was asked my opponent about in that county, the Bryant case, and the record is actually in the record for this court. And just by contrast, if you look at what that judge did in considering the psychological testimony about negated pregnancy and neonaticide, that court found that it helped the court to understand the situation to the extent that in the future there could be a strong possibility of early judicial release. That it was useful in understanding how it all happened, even though it's not a defense to the crime. For 20 years, the last 20 years, the General Assembly has expanded post-conviction relief for post-conviction petitioners, but the courts have not followed suit. They have treated these claims the exact same way. This court recognized in State versus Nichols that there was a view of the post-conviction relief process as virtually futile. Unfortunately, not much has changed since then. This court should use this case as an avenue to instruct lower courts as to how to treat these claims.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.